Shirley Barnes.
Did you say the last name?
Shirley Barnes. Molly Weinstein.
She can't swear.
Alan Deal. Pam Edens.
These are three together.
Yes, Pam Edens, Mary Davenport.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight regarding this very...
Please, Dennis, finish up the record.
...coming sensitive issue. I am Pam Edens, Oregon Alzheimer's Disease Association Advocacy Coordinator Volunteer, and I have a family member with Alzheimer's disease. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Alzheimer's Disease Related Disorders Association Advocacy Committee, which represents thousands of family members of an Alzheimer's disease related disorders victim in Oregon. We are in support of Senate Bills 20 and 21. Alzheimer's disease is the fourth leading cause of death in older adults following heart attack, cancer, and stroke. Currently, there are approximately 50,400 Oregonians with Alzheimer's disease. This disease is terminal, and no cure exists. The final death of an Alzheimer's disease victim is looked at as being the second death of their loved one. The first death comes with the death of the person's mind, their memory, personality, intellect, warmth, etc. The final death of the body is of the body, and that's a time for families to honor their loved one's wishes, whatever they might be. We want the ability of options for families when death is imminent. The family's decision on death for their loved one does not come easily, but with the legal ability of choice comes more options, and therefore the best decision for the loved one is made. The fear that some individuals have that senile people would be put to their death is simply unfounded. Alzheimer's disease is what used to be diagnosed as senility. I have met with hundreds of family members who have a loved one with Alzheimer's disease across Oregon. They want to give their loved one the best possible care and love, and what they want to also give their victim is what the victim themselves wants for their future and their death. Families hope for a cure tomorrow, but families have to prepare themselves for medical complications that can arise. They want a full range of options that best fit with the desires and wishes that they know their loved one would want. We support the decisions each family eventually has to make at the time of death. The family wants all that medical technology can provide to keep their loved one alive. We support that choice. The family decides to allow their loved one to die without any form of medical intervention. We also support that choice, which is what Senate Bill 20 does give. One of the many concerns family have for their loved one is how to best preserve their dignity. And part of the dignity family members carry on for their loved one are the options in regard to death. And we know that you've been given a very difficult task to decide the fate of this bill. And we ask that you give Oregonians the individual right to privacy and let a person choose their own death or the death of a loved one, which is based on a full range of options that Senate Bill provides.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mary Davenport from Portland, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm also a volunteer and a board member of the Alzheimer's Disease and Related Disorders Association in Portland. Let me say first, somebody commented that the hearings that were held for this were not well publicized. I actually attended the first hearing on seeing the notice in the paper because of my own interest and not the interest of the association. It seemed to be, it was very clearly indicative of the time, the place, and the subject. So I think anybody who was interested in the subject could have attended any of the hearings. I speak for myself and and those Oregonians of ADRDA who are in support of Senate Bill 20, the Death with Dignity Bill. We are asking for the choice the bill provides with the safeguards written into it. My own feelings as to this matter are further enhanced by my recent association with Alzheimer's victims and their families. It's our fervent desire that those in the natural process of dying who so choose have the right to avoid the intrusion of artificial means for preserving life, including hydration and feeding tubes. Alzheimer's disease does not allow families or caregivers to know when or how a victim will die. Families and caregivers have the closest knowledge of the wishes of the Alzheimer's victim and are most qualified to see that those wishes are honored. Alzheimer's victims are confused at best and utterly incognitive at worst. From my conversations with many families in support groups and listening to their personal accounts and reading accounts in newsletters throughout the country, it is obvious that Alzheimer's victims cannot be convinced that invasive measures, such as tubes, might be for their own good, since they have lost the ability to reason. They suffer trauma, discomfort, and even pain, and usually try to pull the tubes out to their added detriment. When anyone, especially an Alzheimer's victim, is in a state of dying, a choice must be allowed so that the natural process is not delayed by artificial means, if it is the wish of the family and has been expressed by the victim. I'm not asking anyone else to choose as I might, nor do I wish anyone else to decide for me. It is also vital that the physician of the dying patient be granted the right to honor and respect the wishes of the victim and family. Alzheimer's itself robs its victims of most of their dignity. They should at least be allowed to die with dignity according to the wishes they've expressed and according to the wishes of their families. We also support Senate Bill 21, which is a vital legal tool for caregivers of Alzheimer's victims and families. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Davenport. Ms. Davenport is a Griff Steinke, Spinnicky?
Yes, he's the president of our association.
Is he going to be here?
Not today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gerald Clark.
Committee members, I'd like to
identify
you. My name is Gerald Clark. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I'd like to give an opposition to Senate Bills 20 and 21. Imminent death faces all of us, but to presume when a person's life will end is to play God. Imminent death would surely come to anyone who does not receive nutrition and hydration. You cannot put a price tag either on life. Quality of life and expected, quote, expected benefits is a very subjective opinion, not to be judged by professionals or anyone due to the varying opinion. In Section 5 of Senate Bill 20, the institution, whether established by a religious organization or not, will have to go against their personal convictions, violate their conscience to accommodate a person who wants to issue a directive to terminate life, even if the patient is known to be in a depressive state, when that institution's philosophy does not go along with euthanasia. I'd like to relate a story briefly, if you'd take time later to read it to its full extent. It's a very important story that took place. The story is of Mrs. Jerry Carlson, who had a son, Ron, who was in an automobile accident and had brain damage. She was told to come to the hospital immediately. He would probably be dead by the time before she got there. 6 hours later, the next words were, "It would have been better if your son had died. He has a very badly bruised brain. It is solid, but he will be a vegetable and probably will never wake up." Her answer was, "I have a strong faith in God and do what you need to do." Next month, he was in intensive care. After the second month, he was still in a coma. The medical staff felt he wasn't going to come around, so they made arrangements for him to go to a convalescent hospital. While there, the medical staff wanted to let Ron die, but his life still hung on. After 5 months, he began to drift in and out of consciousness. He developed a swelling of the brain, and she asked if they could do something, and the doctor's reply was no. She had to make a decision to remove him from the hospital and send him to another. There they said he would be dead in 6 more days unless they operated. The operation was a success, and he healed amazingly fast. After 5 months, Ron was still some comatose. They kept him in the hospital for 2 months and then sent him to a convalescent hospital. There they took all medication and food from him. In two weeks, he went from 135 pounds to 109 pounds. At that time, she fired the doctor and got another doctor. The doctor put him back in intensive care, started feeding him well, and then he started doing better. And then they took him to a rehabilitation center, and but there they were afraid he would die and didn't want to be responsible. She had to make arrangements to, because pressure was being made on her that they were going to let him die. 8 months after the accident, doctors were saying he was a quad, but she had to prove that he wasn't a quad because he would respond to her, but not to the doctors and to the staff. Also, she requested that doctors close the trachea tube for he had pneumonia for 3.5 years. This, by the way, took place on February 14th, 1979. That was the time of the accident. After 3.5 years of battling medical force, Ron started to get better, started to gain weight, and started to use a computer for speech communication. In 5 years, with some money, Mrs. Carlson was able to keep him at home. He now stands, is trying to walk, goes to junior college, is trying to talk, learning to take care of himself. He feeds himself, shaves himself, and brushes his own teeth. His intellect was not damaged, just his motor skills. His IQ is over that of a 12th grader. The point being is that the medical field, in summary, that worked with Ron, most of them was against and said that he would die and he would be a vegetable the rest of his life. They were wrong, giving time. And
I have to keep moving. Okay. Just go ahead and wind up very quickly, okay. Please.
Basically, that the medical staff have said there now that yet today there is so much we still do not know about the body recovery. Okay. Who are we to make final decisions?
Okay.
That's the medical staff. And with that, I'll close and urge you not to pass Senate Bill 2021. Thank you for your time.
Mary Kangas.
I am Mary Kangas from Route 1, Box 293, Scappoose, and I reside in Washington County. I am the editor and publisher of the Oregon Catholic News. Now, I am in opposition to both of these bills in their entirety, and I think it is imperative that we all understand that which is being requested of you today and the reasons for the request. This is very important. I think that some of our task force members have been pressured into what they have done, and if necessary, I can bring forth evidence on this. Now, I am, for the first time in the history of our country, state legislators are being asked to legalize the murder, suicide, and assisted suicide of their constituents, and furthermore, to enact these proposed acts in the name of the people of the state of Oregon. I would remind you that those who govern and have temporary custody of our money and papers govern through the delegated power granted to them by the people. We who have delegated this power to you do not have the power to take the life of, nor assist in taking the life of, any innocent person. So we cannot delegate to you a power that we ourselves do not have. Now, I would be interested in learning from whom the opponents or anybody else believes you get this power, because you don't have the power to even be listening to this bill, let alone passing it. You do not have the right to pass a bill to kill anyone. So these proposed acts are going to effectively decide who will live and die, when in the reasonable medical judgment of the attending physician, of course, the incapacitated person 15 years of age or older, they're not able to participate knowledgeably in these decisions regarding their medical care. And I would ask how many people in this room who are not incapacitated have the ability to be able to be knowledgeably, to participate knowledgeably in these medical decisions in their complex and sophisticated manner that they are in today. And remember that these incapacitated persons include children 15 age of year and under. They're 15, they're babies, they're children. Now, one of the main reasons for these proposed acts, of course, is an attempt to make legal that which is not legal. And the provision in Section 9 for the purpose of granting immunity to doctors and hospitals against any civil action by negating their responsibility for their actions. And they may bring anybody before them whom they so choose to bring before you, and they may cry. If they want to kill those people, they want their son dead, kill them. If they want anyone who wants to be killed, let them kill each other. But don't come over here and ask you to do it in my name. That's wrong. It's illegal. That's the first thing it is. It's illegal. For you have taken an oath to uphold life, not uphold death. And let us all remember that oath. Then we come down to the, were it legally possible in the first place for any of you to enact legislation mandating the murder, suicide, or assisted suicide of your constituents, then that would become a law. It would be superfluous to include Section 9 into this. Why would you have to give them immunity? After all, if you had the power to make a law, you wouldn't have to do that. They could already do it, because they're already doing these things now. They want your protection now, but you can't offer that protection because you don't have it to offer. Now we come to the real thing, what we are really doing in this bill, and I think it's imperative that we all become aware of this. I haven't heard it mentioned today. What we are seeing is fiscal euthanasia. It is, and through cost containment, we are actually rationing medical care. That's what we are doing. And the people who are bearing the brunt of this are the old people and the poor people. Because their DRGs are up, and believe me, when your DRGs are up, you are thrown out of that hospital. And there's no way you're going to get back in. It doesn't matter if you've got tubes dangling, if you can't swallow, if you can't walk, they throw you out. But I want to make a point here of why this is happening. These doctors, I traveled from Scappoose today, and I have sat through this all day long.
Miss Kangas,
and no, I need
Ms.
a few.
Kangas, I
need.
I will give you a few minutes, but
thank
you have
you.
To hurry.
I am hurrying.
We have other people who come from a long ways,
that.
Just like you have.
Now, what we have happened was in July 1st, 1984, before that time, Medicare used to reimburse the hospitals by a retrospective payment, okay? And then that paid for all the hospitalization a patient needed during that time, and they weren't concerned about cost containment. But then Congress, and this is where you should be working, is sending someone from this talking to the delegation from here to go back to Congress and get this bill changed, and then you wouldn't have to kill these people for cost containment. And that's why it's happening. So they went back, they adopted what was called the diagnosis-related groups, and they are DRGs. So the health care financing group back there listed up 468 illnesses out of the air. They picked these DRGs, and they determined how much money would be paid for the hospital care of these people. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, if you have 3,500 is allowed for the hospital to stay of a patient with a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is COPD, if the admission is short and the testing limited, the hospital may spend $2,500 and thus earn an extra $1,000 because they get that money anyway. And this is where the horror of this thing is. And doctors are buying into this through the alphabet soups of HPOs, PPOs, IPOs, PPSs, and DRGs, and they don't even care about the patients anymore. Because they are getting paid by the hospital, they are partners with the hospital, and there's conflict of interest. And somebody in this legislature better do something about this, and never mind thinking of passing bills you have no right to be passing.
Ms. Kangas, is this contained in your
Yes, it certainly
testimony?
Contains it, and I am very disturbed over this, because you are sitting here all day long. I realize that most of the time as you're not listening, you're waiting. You can't wait to please get out, and I know that because you're tired. I do not like the idea of remarks being made out in the hall, however.
Ms. Kangas,
I can hardly
Kangas,
wait because I'm going to laugh at them. I heard you, Mr. Hill.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next witness will be Aloha Shade.
My name is Aloha L. Shade. I am appearing in two capacities, one as an individual this evening and also on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union. Senator Hamby, I have a copy of the cover letter which accompanied
the
petition.
Copies. Yes, thank you.
Good. First, in my capacity as a representative for the ACLU, I have been asked to appear on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Portland, Oregon, in general support of Senate Bills 20 and 21. After due consideration, the American Civil Liberties Union Board of Directors adopted a policy statement regarding life and death decisions, and this happened last year. A summary of that policy statement is as follows, and I don't know if you have, in the course of your work, received a copy of this document, but you might find it of interest. I'll provide one to you maybe tomorrow.
Thank you.
This ACLU policy provides guidelines with respect to who makes decisions in difficult life and death situations and by what process those decisions are made. The focus is on cases in which a patient is medically judged to be terminally ill and has not previously and cannot now express his or her true wishes regarding life supporting treatments. It is assumed that in cases where such a patient has previously expressed his or her wishes, as for example through a living will, that those wishes should be acted upon. And as we know today, that is a very large assumption, and that is why we are looking at modifying Chapter 97. The ultimate goal of the process is to honor the presumed wishes of the patient, and specifically, and I think this may be of help to you, Senators, the aims of this policy are to, one, protect the autonomy, dignity, and comfort of the patient, and second, to outline a basis for determining who should be involved in the decision-making process and for excluding from the process persons and information that should be dealt with elsewhere. Third, describe the process by which the decision is to be made and a standard for the decision to be reached. And fourth, to assure timely consideration in the decision-making process of all available relevant information and to establish a basis for minimizing the harassment of legitimate participants. Those are the policy goals of the statement, which I've given to you. And in conclusion, I would like to say that Senate Bills 20 and 21 are carefully drawn efforts to enable those closest to a terminally ill patient, including that patient himself or herself, to act in a congruence with that patient's terminal condition and also with that patient's wishes, were he or she able to express what should be done at the irreversible end of life in order to avoid prolonging inevitable death. That's the end of my testimony on behalf of the ACLU.
Thank you.
Sure. Now, just one other very quick thing. I am also an attorney in private practice in Portland. And, of course, one of the questions which we like to ask sometimes, and I expect to be asked, is, have you executed a directive to physicians? And the fact is, as I considered my testimony today, I realized I would have to say no, that I had not. So I have here a directive under the old statute, which I submit to you is inadequate, but since it is the best we have, I'm going to execute it now, and it will be properly witnessed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Shirley Barnard.
You just saw your hand moving. You didn't see your signature.
My name is Shirley Barnard. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon for the last 51 years. I'm a mother of six children and a Roman Catholic. When my third child was 10 years old, she became very ill, and after 6 months of daily vomiting was diagnosed as having a brain tumor. A craniotomy was performed, and we were told she had a terminal condition as it was malignant and had infiltrated into the brainstem. For 13 years, I was told by every doctor I took her to that this was a terminal condition and would return. If this death with dignity law were in force at that time, I doubt very much that my daughter would be alive today. As it is, she is now 30 years old, married, mother of a four-month-old baby girl, and working at a full-time job, thanks to the power of prayer. This is the miracle in my life. Several years ago, I had another incident occur in my family. My father-in-law fell on the ice and suffered a hip fracture. He had surgery to replace a ball joint, and as a complication of the operation, developed blood clots in his lungs. He was given heparin to dissolve the clots, but unknown to the doctors, had a stress ulcer, so he almost bled to death. Over a period of many months in a nursing home, he became very depressed, stopped eating, and almost died from lack of food and liquids. Thanks to a very caring nurse, he was sent to the hospital, and with the help of IVs and feeding tubes, plus antidepressants, was brought back to health. At a later time, he suffered a perforation from changing a catheter, which resulted in a blood sepsis, or general blood poisoning, which caused his kidneys to shut down. He again became very depressed and was too ill to eat or drink. The doctor told us he had a very poor chance of surviving, but with the help of IVs and antibiotics, he was again restored to health. He is now 90 years old, mentally alert, and enjoying his life. Again, if this death with dignity law were in force, my children would not have their grandfather around. I am opposed to Senate Bills 20 and 21 and urge you to vote against this death law. And thank you for listening and letting me tell my stories of near tragedies. And I want to add one more note. There is no dignity in starving a person to death. There is no dignity in withdrawing fluids and nutrition. That's a horrible death. That's what the people in Africa are doing. They're starving to death, and I don't think it's dignified at all. I think it's disgusting. I think I'm ashamed to think that we have senators in the state of Oregon that would even consider putting a bill forth in front of you people. I think it insults your intelligence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barnard. William E. Baker.
Gosh, this looks like a Douglas Williams.
I can't read the address either. It starts with a D, and it looks like the last initials are W, and I believe it's from Portland. I'm really not sure.
Did you write
your
name on the blackboard just to make sure?
Is it Weiss or?
It does look like Douglas.
Are there any?
It looks like a Douglas.
Any
Douglas.
Witnesses in the audience whose first name is or Douglas? Is Douglas? Well, come on forward.
He's got to be a doctor.
3415. I can see the numbers. Is your address 3415?
I printed when I signed in. Are you looking at?
No.
No, that isn't you.
Is your signature?
No, that's not me.
If there are other witnesses who want to testify in favor of the bill who have not testified, if you could report to one of our committee assistants and give them your name. Other than that, we'll be going on to a remaining persons who are testifying in opposition to the bill.
Okay.
Patricia Smith.
Patricia Smith.
My name is Patricia Smith from Canby, Oregon. I am a wife, mother, teacher, and a daughter of two aging parents. No one in this room wishes to die sooner than necessary, nor do any of us want our lives unduly prolonged if our time has come. For every sad story of a comatose or suffering patient, there are several stories of persons who are not supposed to make it, but they did. They are here to tell us about it and are leading productive lives. The real question today is not is there a problem, but does Senate Bill 20 adequately address the problem? I think not. Legislation regarding life-death decision-making must do two things. First of all, it must address the questionable situations in a clear, well-defined manner which protects persons outside of the crisis states. Today, we have heard fairly clear and well-defined descriptions of vegetable situations and vegetative situations and this kind of thing. Why cannot the law be a little more clear in its definition? The second thing it must do is state clearly who holds the authority and responsibility. Senate Bill 20 inadequately attempts the second and fails to do the first. Its ambiguity and free choice stance places a blanket of vulnerability on every living person to an untimely death with the phrase active and natural process of dying. In the next section, I have outlined things that have been covered very well today already, but I would like to address the control factors that need to be included in pro-life legislation. The four control factors which are missing in Senate Bill 20 are, first of all, the nature of the illness, the reversibility, the duration, and fourth of all, the competency of the decision maker. The primary person holding authority and responsibility for decisions should be competent. Section 4 of Senate Bill 20 allows the patient to revoke a directive regardless of mental or physical condition, a directive that they made while competent. This could prolong life for a patient choosing option 1 of the directive, but it could end life for a patient who originally chose option 3 of the suggested directive. For example, 20 years ago, my mother, seriously ill in the hospital, reached a low emotional level and stated, "I just want to die."
We physicians must take care that support for an innocent but quite unnecessary living will does not pave the way for us to be executioners while the decisions for death are made by a panel of objective experts or by Big Brother himself. The year 1984 is not far away. C. Everett Koop, M.D., and Malcolm Muggeridge, forgive me, in the same book both point out that Hitler's Holocaust began with euthanasia. The guiding philosophy of the Nazis was Hegelian in that, I guess I should have read this earlier, in that what was considered rational utility and corresponding doctrine and planning had replaced moral, ethical, and religious values. I suggest that we as a nation already operate on the basis of rational utility when the U.S. Supreme Court can decide a nationwide policy of abortion on demand that even our own president writes is not constitutional law and gives almost no sense of obligation to be. Our Declaration of Independence stated the vision of our forefathers using words school children recite. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they endowed by their creator and with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In my opinion, neither SB 20 nor 21 is consistent with our Declaration of Independence, but rather with the Nazis' Hegelian philosophy of rational utility. It's signed Karen LeBlanc, 1276 Northeast 9th place in Canby, Oregon, and I've got written testimony, and I will pass it out to you. I also have, I would like to go on record, there's a lady in Hillsborough. Her name is Joanne K. Cruzman. She lives at 933 Northwest 10th. She's against this bill, and I have a Dr. Finley that is in Tigert, and he's also against this bill, and thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Friel. Next witness, David Ingerson. Joe Spinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Joe Spinner, 15016 Coon Hollow Road, Southeast State in Oregon. I do believe that this bill, these two bills are so important that they touch on the very precious element of our lives that we should present that to the people for their consent. Government derives its just consent from the people. And I'm very concerned about the poor people. We can see the problems that the Mexican people have in their country and when they come across how they're being treated. I'm a jail visitor. I visit Marion County Jail. I see the difficulties that the minorities have because they're poor, only because they're poor. What happens in here? I'm also on the Sanya Memorial Hospital Board of Directors, and I can see the concern that economics is playing in this. Economics, the dollar. We have lost that warm human touch for people. This is what we have to look for in here. It's too cold, too cold, too cut and dried. We don't have enough compassion in there for the poor people. Let's look out for that. It's so easy to say when someone's in there. And yet, I can see also that sometimes doctors do have a problem with certain patients. But even yet, let's give the patient the number one priority. When people are in hospital, when they're ill, I had an experience in 1980s on this. My weight went from 140 down to 119 in just 2 weeks' time, some kind of a fever that they couldn't find the answer for right away. It would have been very easy to have persuaded me then. There was one word that a doctor did write on there. I won't mention it. It would have maimed me for life if I hadn't caught that. But somehow I had enough sense to ask and question what that word was. It would have been very easy to have fallen in with the death with dignity deal. But I recovered. I'm a healthy 65 now. Not too long ago, I ran 4 miles in 47 minutes. I'm getting close to my 4-gallon blood donation. So let's be careful when we write off people. When we look through history, we see that some people who were handicapped have been our greatest contributors. So let's take a look at the traditional American warmth. And let's take a look at the future that we can. I'd like to tell you about a man who was hit on the back of the neck with a large limb, so hard that it knocked his front teeth out. He laid in the hospital for nearly 2 months in a coma. Now he's recovered. Of course, he's in a wheelchair, but he's running a computer, helping his brothers with a cattle ranch. We have to keep the American principle alive and work for that. There are cases with improving technology and medicine and such like that some of these people can be recuperated. But we have to work on that word, compassion, affection, neighborliness again. Let's get away from the cold professionalism. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spinner. Next witness, Mr. John Scheiss.
Good evening, Senator Hill, members of the committee. My name is John Chess.
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 Sorry.
Checkmate.
Sorry.
Game. Chess. Actually, it's correctly pronounced Sheese, but I don't want to take all my time explaining my history here. I hesitate to testify, and I've listened to some of the testimony. It's a very touchy issue, an emotional issue, and there's one point that comes to mind that I wanted to make. I'm trying to simplify a complex matter. First of all, I want to say I'm against the bill and encourage you to table it or kill it. Is that who has the responsibility to take care of somebody? Who has the responsibility to make a decision over someone's life? Well, if we look at the various levels of government, we have the individual, the family, the local government, which can be county or city, and the state and federal. And the people are concerned if we go above the family level and get into the state making decisions, because then that may open a door to euthanasia. I think the decision has to remain with the family. And the crux of the problem is when we take a look at you and I, if I have a medical problem, or you do, and I've spent all my means to do all I can to preserve your life, where do I have the right to get the money from at that point for medical treatment that I can't afford? If I can do that, if you can do that for me and take someone else's money that I don't have the right to take, pay for this medical help, then you can do that to everybody, and you can give it to anybody, whether it be in this country or outside this country. Now, I don't know if I'm making this point clear, and it sounds maybe inhumane, but I'm just saying that there's a natural process of life, and there's a time, as someone has said, a time to live and a time to die. And people who don't believe anything higher than themselves have a difficult time dealing with that. We all want to take care of somebody who can't afford medical treatment, but we don't have the right to take somebody else's property to do that. And the decision whether to continue treatment or implement technology that can't be afforded has to rest primarily with the family and the guardian, the person responsible for paying the bill. And that's basically the point I wanted to make. One last thing that doesn't sound like this is related, but I feel like putting it on the record. There's an organization that testified for this bill, and I'd like to read a quote about it. Its leader says, "We want to look like patriots in everything we do. We want to get a lot of good flags and talk a good deal about the Constitution." A fact-finding committee in California said this organization may definitely be classified as a communist front or transmission belt organization. At least 90% of its efforts are expended on behalf of communists who come in conflict with the law. While it professes to stand for free speech, a free press, and free assembly, it is quite obvious that its main function is to protect communists in their activities of force and violence and their program to overthrow the government, replacing the American flag with the red flag and erecting a Soviet government in place of the Republican form of government guaranteed by our state and federal government. That organization is the ACLU. Thank you. Yeah, glad to take any questions.
Next witness, last name is Caldwell, representing PL Media.
She spoke already.
Okay, thank you. Rosemarie Belazos. Belazos.
I knew I'd get done in 5 minutes. I don't know if I'll make it in three, but I'll try. My name is Rosemarie Belazos.
Belazos.
I'm from Milwaukee, Oregon, Senator Cohen's district. We are in opposition of Senate Bill 20 and 21, my family of five registered voters, for so many reasons that we think that this bill should be voided. Life is a treasure. Death is a natural event. Scientists, physicians, and legislators are called to place their skills and energy at the service of life. They can never, for any reason or in any case, suppress it. For all who have a keen sense of the supreme value of human persons, believers and non-believers alike, euthanasia is a crime in which one must in no way cooperate or even consent to. It is the task of the doctors and the medical workers to give the sick the treatment from which will help to cure them and which will aid them to bear their suffering with dignity. Even when the sick are incurable, they are never untreatable. Whatever their condition, appropriate care should be provided for them. Withholding nutrition and hydration is unforgivable omission and must not be allowed. The pleas of the gravely ill people who sometimes ask for death are not to be understood as implying a true desire for euthanasia. In fact, it is almost always a case of an anguished plea for help and love. What a sick person needs besides medical care is love and the human and supernatural warmth with which a sick person can and ought to be surrounded by all those close to him or her, parents and children, doctors and nurses. Legislators, scientists, physicians are not the lord of life, but neither are they the conqueror of death. My husband's father lived with us for 3 years before he died at the age of 93. Months before he died, his health began to fail. He didn't want to eat, and we had to coax and persist that he take some food and liquid each day. This only required more patience on our part for caring for him. When he suffered a stroke before his death, we were never sure just what he was hearing or understanding. His eyes, his face, his body's motions said many things to us, but what we thought they said and what he was trying to relate to us might have been completely different. He didn't tell us either that he wanted to die, nor did we starve him, nor did we assist him. He did suffer, but we prayed with him and for him. You see, according to Christian teaching, suffering during the last moments of life has a special place in God's saving plan. And it is, in fact, a sharing in Christ's passion and a union with the redeeming sacrifice which he offered in obedience to the Father's will. You must not be surprised if some Christians prefer to accept voluntarily at least a part of their suffering and thus associate themselves in conscious way with the suffering of Christ crucified. May I suggest that you read the Vatican Declaration on Euthanasia, for it states, nothing and no one in any way permit the killing of an innocent human being, whether it a fetus or an embryo or an infant or an adult, an old person, or one suffering from an incurable disease, or a person who is dying. Furthermore, no one is permitted to ask for this act of killing, either for himself or herself, or for another person entrusted in his or her care,
nor can he or she consent to it, either explicitly or implicitly. Nor can any authority legitimately recommend or permit such an action, for it is a question of violation of the divine law, an offense against the dignity of the human person, a crime against life, and an attack on humanity.
Thank you very much. Yes, next will be Jane Marchionis. And after Ms. Marchionis will be Mary Schaefer.
Senator Hill and members of the Judiciary Committee, the proposed legislation changes the law in a number of significant respects. Generally, by expanding the number of situations in which care and treatment may
sorry,
or must be withheld.
I'm sorry, did you give your name?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Jane Marchionis from Oregonians for Patients' Rights. Oregon death legislation in both its current form and under SB 20 has two main effects. First, when an individual has executed a directive, the legislation prohibits the administration of certain care and treatment. Second, in some other situations, with or without a directive, the legislation authorizes the withholding of certain care and treatment. How does Senate Bill 20 expand the range of situations in which care and treatment may or must be withheld? First, Senate Bill 20 provides for the non-treatment of infants and other minors and for people not suffering from terminal illnesses. Current law applies only to adults suffering from terminal conditions. Second, Senate Bill 20 includes food and water as forms of treatment which must be withheld if a person has made a directive. Unless the person explicitly limits the directive, a directive will automatically forbid the mechanical and artificial provision of food and fluids. Third, any communication, written or otherwise, suffices as a directive under Senate Bill 20. The communication need not be voluntary. Thus, a directive which a person is pressured or coerced into giving, even a mere oral, okay, don't treat me, would legally prohibit the giving of care and treatment. Fourth, Senate Bill 20 removes virtually all patient protection from biased witnesses. Under SB 20, interested or even hostile parties may validly witness a directive. Fifth, SB 20 creates a new category of situations in which care and treatment may be withheld even without a directive. When the patient is incapacitated but not comatose, is in the active and natural process of dying, and does not object, care and treatment may be withheld at the request of certain third parties. For example, if a diabetic ward of the state becomes mentally confused and the state requests the withholding of life-sustaining procedures, then insulin may be withheld, causing the patient to succumb to the dying process brought on by diabetes. Finally, SB 20 removes the conscience rights of nurses who object to participation in the withholding of life-sustaining treatment. SB 21 represents a different approach and presents some distinct additional concerns. This bill empowers anyone over age 14, the principal, to name any other person over age 14, the attorney in fact, to make health care decisions on behalf of the first person or principal. The bill allows for a broad delegation of authority in treatment matters. This creates the potential for abuse. In particular, the bill does not require that the decision to appoint a surrogate decision maker be voluntary. Nor does SB 21 disqualify insurance representatives, heirs, or many other financially interested parties from assuming the role of decision maker for another person. That the bill allows even 15-year-olds to make binding appointments of surrogate decision makers only enhances the potential for abuse. Virtually every day, the media report on escalating health care costs, and many public leaders and commentators call for measures to limit medical expenditures. Growing social and economic pressures create strong incentives to withhold or omit treatment. It is therefore incumbent upon lawmakers to protect patients against the overeager denial of treatment. Yet, the legislation before this committee would make it much easier to deprive a patient of treatment and would thus expose patients to the force of growing budgetary pressures against medical care. Both SB 20 and 21 suffer from deficiencies which jeopardize patient welfare and the integrity of the medical profession. The present social context only aggravates these deficiencies. I strongly urge the Judiciary Committee to give serious attention to these concerns. This above analysis was prepared for the Judiciary Committee by Mr. Walter Weber, Associate General Counsel for the Catholic League for Civil and Religious Rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark Jones. Mary Schaefer. The next witness after Ms. Schaefer would be Catherine Lapeer.
I'm Mary Elizabeth Schaefer from Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I am opposed to the bills, Senate Bills 20 and 21. First, life-sustaining procedures, by definition, includes food and water. This definition needs to be rewritten so that the meaning states clearly extraordinary life-sustaining measures for what can be safely diagnosed as true terminal illnesses. Otherwise, the Senate Bills 20 and 21 just cannot escape becoming the first step in opening the door to euthanasia and so-called mercy killing. We do not want to start our state of Oregon down the road engineered by Hitler in Germany. With the legalization of abortion, we are already headed in that direction. We must begin changing our direction and above all keep our state a safe place for the elderly to be able to live out their days. Second, death by starvation is definitely not a painless death. Furthermore, assisted suicide is a crime and should remain so. We have drugs for easing pain, and in this area is where we should concentrate our compassion and mercy for the ill with a terminal diagnosed disease. Poorly written bills, which these are, without very clear intent against euthanasia, should never be passed by the Oregon legislature. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Sheikh. Catherine Lapeer.
Honorable members of the committee, Judiciary Committee, I'm glad I waited until all this time to be heard, but I won't keep you longer. You know, it's late, but I have heard so much excellent testimony.
Just identify yourself for the record.
Pardon? Oh, yes, and my name is Catherine LaPierre. It's Pierre, right. Pierre Peter. Peter, the rock of the church.
Yes.
And it said, you know, as Christ said, you are Peter and you are rock. And, well, now I know it by heart, but because I'm here, I'm missing out on it. And the gates of hell, he said, and the gates of hell shall not prevail. He said, and he founded the church on Peter the Rock, and the gates of hell shall not prevail. And so that's why I'm here to give my testimony, along with the other excellent testimony given with the others. So I'm going to forego some of my storytelling and just get down to say that my husband and I are senior citizens, and we are definitely opposed to the legislators passing S-Bill 21, 20 and 21. Currently, we are protected from euthanasia. Oregon law now limits life-sustaining procedures to terminal illness where death is imminent. SB 20 and 21, however, remove the criteria of terminal illness and imminent death. SB 20 and 21 define life-sustaining procedures to include nutrition and hydration. Taking persons off machines is one thing, and most of us would not want to be kept alive on machines. And that's, of course, called the extraordinary measures, and you don't have to keep people on machines. That's really allowed to take them off. It isn't necessary because that's artificial. You don't have to artificially keep people alive. However, removing food and water is quite another thing in keeping a patient comfortable, and that they should continue to give people food and water. even if they take them off machines, which is allowed. Oregon law must protect its citizens and not put them under the practice of euthanasia. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. LaPierre. Next witness, Ronald Engman. Helen Myers? I'm sorry. Sorry,
no,
sir.
I'm Ronald Engman, just working too many hours lately.
Yeah.
So, get comfortable. I represent concerned citizens of Portland. Oh, my name is Ronald Engman, Portland, Oregon. I represent concerned citizens of Portland. And I strongly recommend that you table this. It's taking the opportunity for life, like we've heard tonight, this evening particularly, a couple individuals that would have not continued on if they had life support had been terminated at certain points. I believe that as long as there is that pounding of that heart, there should be a chance for that person. There was some very extenuating circumstances in some cases, but I don't accept those, I'm afraid. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alice Bueller. Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought you said Helen Myers.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Very sorry.
That's okay. I'm Helen Myers from Sand Lake, Tillamook County. I will dispense with a lot of the repetition. I think Kelly Clark, who was an attorney from West Lynn, brought out some marvelously valid points. The only thing he didn't say, and unless your Judiciary Committee gets rid of some of this unnecessary laws, torts, and so forth, I don't know whether anybody'd sue you or not. I'm 81, and I trust my family. My mother lived to be over 100, and she was pulling those things out of her nose and her mouth, and the doctor said, Helen, what are we going to do? I said, she has expressed the opinion she wants to go. And I think most of us are for when people want to die with dignity. But this, I'm trying to be a lady, this, these two bills, don't table them, kill them, bury them. Dr. Charles Norris gave some very, very good testimony, I thought, and I agree with him and with Kelly Clark and the people that are opposed to this. I don't think we need all these bills. Who's going to pay for all this? This is a little different on saying paying for it, but our lives are important. And I'm not kidding you. If you folks pay this and if anything happens to me, I'm going to come back and haunt you.
Thank you, Mrs. Myers. Alice Bueller.
Hi, my name is Alice Bueller. I live in Portland, Oregon. I just looked at this bill when I got here tonight. I was thinking this was going to be so crowded I wouldn't have time to testify, but some things really bounced out at me when I looked at it. In Section 1, it says life-sustaining procedures means any medical procedure or intervention utilizing mechanical or other artificial means, including mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration. And, you know, it's mechanical for me to lift a fork to my mouth. I mean, you know, what do you want to call mechanical? Artificial provision of nutrition. You know, we have trucks that deliver food to us. Isn't that artificial? I mean, we don't just go out and pick it from the grass. I just, you know, food is food. In Section 2, it says, any person who is not incapacitated may direct in writing, orally, or in any other manner that effectively communicates their wishes. And I'm thinking, well, what is going to be done with that if someone can supposedly orally say, please kill me, how are you going to, what type of contracts are done orally like that in a life or a death matter? Then in section 7, it says when a person not described has not signed a directive and they become comatose for at least 60 days, someone can pull the plug, can take away their nutrition, and it lists all the people that can do it, including an attending physician. So me, as a Catholic Christian, can fall into a comatose. I'm not a lawyer here, but it looks like I can get into a coma, and an attending physician can tell me, you know, can pull the plug on me against my own religious beliefs. That's what it looks like to me here. It says in the following order, these people may do it. It doesn't say these people can't do it. It doesn't say that if the spouse says no, the guardian says no, the parent says no, that the attending physician cannot say yes, from what I can read here. So it's a matter of who can say yes that I can see. They can pull the plug. I've heard it statement often, sanctity of life in opposition to quality of life. There is no quality of life unless life is respected. That's not quality of life. Starvation is not a natural process. You can look to the people in Africa to see that it's not such a natural process. These people look like they're not having a lot of fun. This thing really seems beyond me, and I understand that there are people out of the state that are heavily lobbying for this and wanted to introduce it into Oregon because we're supposedly one of the most liberal states that there are, and if it would pass here, then they could take it to all the other states, and I really resent my state being used as a trial place to push other people's ideas on me. My dad was dying in Germany, and I went to visit him, and had he not been kept on food, I would not have had the most treasured times that I've had with my dad. We were able to really say how we loved each other. And, of course, he